good for us to be here, and it's good that we have come together this morning to be welcomed into the house of the Lord and have some lessons that's going to help us as we make our way from earth to heaven. I want to give you a little quick and dirty commercial before we start this. I want you to remember that on the 6th of November it'll be daylight savings time, so we can be the worship on time as well. Amen. 6th of November, daylight savings time. Just remember that. I want to tell you that, again, you're welcome, whether you're here virtual this morning or whether you're here present. We always want to welcome you at the Church of Christ of Franklin Street for anything that you might have need of. The elders stand, they're standing by to be able to help you with that as well as myself. My name is Brother Collins. I'm going to introduce you to a fellow that some of you have been acquainted with, and we're going to reacquaint ourselves with him as well and introduce you to others as well. I've come to know him and love him as well. He's helped me tremendously with a whole lot of things since we've met each other. And I've known him very well as the barefoot preacher. The barefoot preacher. He runs barefoot all the time. He's that's one of his hobbies. And he also ran a couple marathons in his life. He enjoys riding a cruiser bike now. But Brother Jerry Barber is a fellow that has a lot of years of experience, of course. You know, age does that for you. But not only does he have a lot of experience because of his age, he has a lot of experience because of his study and his work with the gospel, leading people to Christ, as well as helping other congregations who may have been without preachers. And when you look at this this list of accomplishments, of course, there's no shortage of things. His interim experience has ranged from Tennessee to Missouri to Indiana, Kentucky, and there's a lot of churches in between that he's helped us with as well. And what I want to do is just be a little salty this morning and tell him he's got to add our congregation there as well, because we feel like, he's a part of this church family here as well at Franklin Street. He's been a full-time minister at the Berry Chapel Church of Christ and West Nashville Heights Church of Christ, Central Church of Christ in Dalton, Georgia, Madisonville Church of Christ, and Yorkville Church of Christ as well. Now, he grew up in Centerville, Tennessee, and right now him and his wife lives in Nashville, Tennessee. He went to Freed Hardeman University, and him and his wife got married on August 18, 1964. Is that right? Is that right, Sister Barbara? That's what he gave us. He gave us the date of August 18, 64, Matt. Is that right? Someone confirm that. You know, we kind of sometimes... Congratulations to y'all on your last anniversary in August of this year. They have two children, six grandchildren, and five great-grandchildren. He's helped with counseling on grief under James Jones, Central Church of Christ in Georgia, and he's providing with principles and skills to deal with people, problems, and with conflict. Served as a co-leader for more than 30 years in workshops, workshop called Leadership Dynamic for Dynamic Leaders as well. And Brother and Sister Barbara participated in a Coaching with Excellence workshop with Dan Miller in January of 2014. Now, he has all these accolades, but I want to tell you that his wife is in the process of writing a book. And we want to be able to have access to that as well. I think at the end of this session, before he leaves, Brother Reed is going to put that in a PDF, and we can pass that out as well. About her experiences in life and how she transitioned to help other people as well in the Church of Christ, especially women who are going through some problems in their lives. We all need some help from time to time, amen? And whether we want to admit it or not, some of those things we don't want to relive because they hurt, but pain certainly at the end of it brings us joy, amen? So we want to welcome Brother Jerry Barber and his wife to the Franklin Street Church of Christ.
Thank you, Brother Collins. Thank you. It is good to be back at Franklin Street. I've been talking about you since 2014. Y'all know how I got here? I got a call probably in September, October from Brother Banks. And he said, "Are you the Jerry Barber that wrote an article in Think Magazine on church conflict? I said, yes, I am. He said, I think I have found a ram in the bush. And so he invited me down. And I was here Friday night and a Saturday, and then another invitation in 2017 that I enjoyed thoroughly. And so this time we said, Gail's going to come. She's heard me talk about you. We've talked several times. I appreciate your elders. They think and they plan. And so they said, here's what we want you to talk about. Coming out of the wilderness. Said, we've been in the wilderness. We've had COVID here and all. Has that kind of disrupted things? That kind of changes the looks of everything, doesn't it? And so how do you get out of the wilderness? And I thought about that. They wanted me to send some topics. And I thought, what's helped me to get out of my wilderness? What kind of wilderness you been in? Well, one of the most painful days in my life was December 19, 1976 at 10:20 in the morning. Not that I keep records or anything. I had been at this church 8 years. We had grown from 200 to 300. Every year we grew. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, contribution. We had knocked on every door in town 3 times, baptized lots of people. And so this particular morning, I taught a Bible class, and one of the elders said, would you step in the office just a minute? And I said, sure. And he said, Brother Jerry, I think you ought to think about resigning this morning. I've been studying my lesson all week long, and I couldn't find that anywhere in my notes. That had never, that never crossed my mind. I got a couple of blogs if you'd like to look them up. One of them is newshepherdsorientation.com, and the other is betweenpreachers.com. And I wrote a blog on the best day to fire your preacher. I hope that doesn't ever happen, but would you like to know, this is my observation, what I've learned from experience, the best day to fire your preacher, which day of the week? I think Monday is the best day. That gives you 3 days to recuperate before Wednesday and 6 before the next Sunday. The absolute worst time is between Bible study and worship. You've got to walk in there and start preaching. But that's when he did it. That's when he did it. And you know the first song we sang? Anywhere is home. That's funny, isn't it? It wasn't funny that morning. You know, they say the difference between tragedy and comedy is about 10 years. And so after 10 years, I could pretty well laugh about that. So that was a painful day. painful winter. That was the winter of 76, 77. And for 30 days, we didn't see the parking lot at Madisonville Church of Christ. There was blizzard after blizzard after blizzard. And in that kind of weather, I was driving all over the country trying to find a job. Another storm I went through, another time I spent some time wandering around in the wilderness, was in 1964. Our son had married, gone to Freed Hardeman College, married a preacher's daughter, and he called us and said, I don't think my marriage is going to work. My wife is not happy with one man. Oh, we did everything right, we thought. We prayed for the parents of that child before. While our child was in the womb and all since that time, and sent him to a Christian college, and he married a preacher's daughter, and look what happened here. Horrible, absolutely horrible. There was 2005 when Gail had a stroke, and they told her she'd never sing again, never speak again, and pretty well wasn't going to be too good. And she said, you give me the work and I'll do it. And she looks pretty well normal now. Normal plus. And so she survived that. And then there was the sickness and death of my dad several years preceding that, and he died in 2009, and then my mother in 2018. So all of us could tell our story. So how do we get to those painful times in life, and how do we come out of the wilderness? And you know, I started thinking about that. There's something you got to do before you come out of the wilderness. What's that? You got to decide whether you want to stay in slavery or not. See, those folks didn't want to, well, I guess they thought it was a pretty good idea when they left, but they turned around and saw Pharaoh coming, and they said, let's go back home. They got cucumbers and stuff there, and this manna, it gets old day after day after day. And so they wandered 40 years. You know how long it takes to get from the Red Sea to Kadesh Barnea, according to Deuteronomy 1 verse 2? 11 days. And it took them 40 years. So we're probably not going to solve the problem this weekend. But maybe, of course, here's my three rules. Y'all remember my three rules? Number one, try not to learn very much. That will be easy with me leading the discussion. Anybody here still enrolled in school? Anybody? I don't see any young people here. If you're in school, don't take my advice. It'll get you in all kind of trouble. But try not to learn very much. Since I got out of school, that's my goal. Love to read. I read many books. Gail and I travel a lot now. We're working in Pacific, Missouri, and that's a day's drive from Nashville. So we listen to books all the time we're writing. Listen to podcasts. Love to do that. Like to go to lectureships. But I try not to learn very much, and generally I'm successful. Don't learn very much. However, try to learn something that will make a difference. I call it the mustard seed principle. Jesus said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you can move a mountain. And that's what we want to do. We want to move mountains and get out of the wilderness. Number two, I don't know what kind of medicine you're taking. Don't know how hard you worked, how much sleep you got last night. You know what I notice every once in a while, Brother Colin? You ever see people, and even hear a snore every once in a while? Let me tell you, if that happens, I want to tell you what I'm going to do. Absolutely nothing. I'm not going to throw down a songbook or make loud noises. You know, it used to bother me when I noticed people sleeping when I was preaching. I thought they were insulting my preaching ability. But when we read the Bible, we can learn a lot of helpful information. Acts chapter 20, one night a man was preaching, a man went to sleep and fell out and died. Who was preaching that night? Paul, good preacher or bad preacher? Probably pretty good preacher. So the fact that somebody goes to sleep doesn't mean your preaching's bad. Secondly, we can learn a lot from experience. That's where wisdom comes from. Taking what's going on, what'd you learn from that, and measure it with a standard in God's Word. I started preaching when I was 16 years old. Started in high school, and so the last 2 years of high school, I had a circuit. I'd go the first Sunday, second Sunday, third Sunday, different congregations, one Sunday, one sermon per month, and I could go around the circuit. And one day in November of 1962, I was about halfway through my sermon at the Wolf Creek Church of Christ in Hickman County, Tennessee. And I said in Hebrews 10, verses 25 and 26, and pow, hit the floor, went to sleep right in the middle of my own sermon. I got up. They took me to Dr. Parker Elrod in Centerville. He examined me, said, I can't find anything wrong with you. And then I went the next day to a doctor in Nashville that had helped me with some thyroid issues, and he did a thorough physical. And both of them said the only thing we can figure is exhaustion. I was a guard on the basketball team. We did a full court press both ways on Friday night. Saturday, Daddy's building Rock House, so I haul rock all day on Saturday. Went bowling Saturday night, got up early Sunday morning studying, about halfway through the sermon, this time taking a nap and I did. So I thought about that through the years. If I go to sleep when I preach, why should I be irritated at other people for doing the same thing? So I'm not. And always, here's one right over here. I always like to have a wastebasket available. If what I say is not worth taking home, feel free to use a wastebasket. Is that fair enough? Can we go by those rules? Here's what I did when Brother Banks and Brother Reed called and said, here's what we want you to talk about. And I got to thinking, What are some principles that have helped me when I was trying to get out of the wilderness? And so that's what I'm going to share with you. This morning, we're going to talk about one of the most helpful principles I ever learned was how to accept, invite, and enjoy criticism. Whoopee, whoopee, whoopee. Don't you just love to be criticized? We're going to talk about an hour and 15 minutes. We'll take about a 10-minute break, and then we're going to come back. I want to be criticized, but not too much. And so we're going to talk about destructive, abusive, bullying criticism. That's different from somebody telling you what they think might be a good idea for you to do better. And so that's been helpful to me. And then tomorrow morning, remembering the way God remembers. Monday night, are you building your life on facts or fairy tales? And then Tuesday night, how can we be connected but not stuck? So let's go to work on criticism. Honest criticism is hard to take, particularly from a relative, a friend, an acquaintance, or a stranger. In other words, it's just tough. It's just tough. I moved to Dalton, Georgia, April 1977. That was where I went after I got fired. Thankfully, the same series of sermons that got me fired in Kentucky got me hired in Georgia. Well, I'd been there about 6 months, and we had a custodian there, and he tried to be helpful. We have, y'all have those little, a lot of people have Vista cards or handouts and that kind of thing. And I don't know if you know it or not, sometimes people write notes on those things and leave them. And when he found something he thought I might be interested in, he said, well, I found this in the pew Sunday morning. Here's the one he found. See, I've only been here a short time after getting fired before I got there. And here's what it said. Our preacher is too young, too immature, too trite. I get nothing from his services, and now he is my Sunday school teacher too. You talk about persecution, man. Anybody in that shape's in bad shape. Here's what's interesting. It was hooked to her ballpoint pen, and her name was inscribed on it. So I gave her the pen back. I kept the card. 1995, I put together a series of classes for leadership development. I called it God's Great Servant. Jesus said in Matthew 20, if you want to be great, be a servant. If you want to be first, be a slave. And so we look at leadership prayers in the Bible, leadership projects. We give situations that elders have to deal with. Divide the big class up into smaller elderships for practice, and we let them work through that decision. And then we look at leadership principles. And the way I like to do that is let people nominate people. Who do you think? What men in this church do you think might be good elders or deacons in the next 3 months or the next 30 or 40 years, anywhere in that? In other words, what men would you suggest? And we've had young men as young as 4 and as old as person they're nominated. So I send everybody a letter. Somebody has noticed in you leadership qualities. And I explain the class, let me know whether you want to attend or not. Here's a letter I got, December 9, 1999. Jerry, I will be perfectly honest with you. I am not, nor will I ever be interested in becoming a leader at this church. I am not interested in your class. I once was a deacon at this church, but have no good memories, only bad ones. People never satisfied, always complaining. I've experienced much the same in my personal life. That's why I'd rather dig the ditch and let someone else get the praise. Thanks for your understanding. Well, I was so excited when I got that, I called him up and I said, man, thank you for taking the time to write that letter. That was outstanding. See, that tells you how people are affected many times by criticism. can we have lunch together? He was a nurse at Vanderbilt Hospital. And we went and had lunch together, and he just kind of told me some of his backgrounds. And so I thought that was powerful. Let's look in the Bible. One of the things we need to recognize when we're coming out of the wilderness, and as even before we get all the way to the wilderness, when we're coming out of Egypt, the leaders are going to be criticized. We're talking about criticism today. That's just part of the price of being, well, who's a leader? I believe every person is a leader of themselves and others. And so if you're an elder, if you're a deacon, if you're a preacher, if you're a mama, if you're a daddy, if you're a supervisor, we're all leaders. We're all leaders. Many times we don't know who we're leading, but somebody's watching us. And so as leaders, we can expect to be criticized. Everybody's not going to be happy with us all the time. Well, they had gone through the 10 plagues. They had left Egypt, and so they turn around and look, and here comes the Egyptians coming right after them. And Pharaoh drew near. This is Exodus 14:10. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Why in the world are you getting us out of there? We'd rather... Present mystery is often better than unknown advantages. We'd rather stay in our misery because we're familiar with it. Numbers chapter 13. They've been wandering around. They finally made it up to Kadesh Barnea. And Moses sends 12 spies into the land. You remember them, Shemuel, Shaphat, Igal, Palti, Gedi, Agada, Ami, Sether, Nabi, Jeuel, Joshua, and Caleb. Probably talked about them at breakfast this morning. And he said, I want you to go into the land. I want you to tell me what kind of people are there. I want you to tell me what kind of cities. Are they fortified or defenseless? I want you to tell me what kind of crops they have there. And they came back and they said, it is a land flowing with milk and honey. And they brought back a bunch of grapes, and if you go to Israel today, you'll see that as a logo on a lot of taxes and businesses and other things. They got this pole and this cluster of grapes that goes all the way down to the ground. And they said, it's wonderful. It just, but, there are giants there. They're giants and we're grasshoppers. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we're well able to overcome it. And the people said, no, they're giants, we're grasshoppers. That was a day when democracy didn't work. They were outvoted 10-2 not to go in and take the promised land. In fact, it gets worse when you get to chapter 14. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in the wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let's select a leader and return to Egypt. We're going to vote this administration out and get us somebody to do what we want them to do. So here we go back to Egypt. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces, Joshua and Caleb. They said, the land we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. And all the congregation said to stone them with stones. That's pretty sharp criticism. And so that's just something that happens. And the only way we'll ever get out of the wilderness is being able to deal with that kind of criticism. If we do what everybody wants to do, we'll walk around in circles for 40 years. And that's what they ended up doing. Oh, aren't you glad we don't live under the Old Testament? It was rough back then. Let's go to the New Testament. Paul, one of the great preachers and missionaries that the world has ever known. You know what people said about him? For some say his letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he is unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing. 2 Corinthians 10:10. I like to summarize that by commenting on Paul the preacher. He's ugly and he can't preach. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to have some critics, but maybe if we tried hard enough and we worked hard enough, maybe we could just get enough, good enough so we wouldn't have all that. Well, yeah, that's probably a possibility. But in Mark 3, verse 22, you know what people said about Jesus? Do you know anybody better than Jesus? That's probably the best you're going to get. They said he cast out demons by the Beelzebub, and by the prince of the demons he cast out demons. Well, yeah, you know, Satan's people are going to be against you, but you know, surely your own people. Well, if you read Mark 3:20-22, his own people came to him and said he is out of his mind. That's his kinfolk. So you'd have to get a lot better than Jesus if you're going to make everybody happy, and you can't make everybody happy, and so the ones that aren't happy are going to criticize. I read about a preacher, and he told about a Sunday. He had got some pretty stinging criticism, so he did what he often did. He called up a buddy and said, can we have lunch? And he unloaded all the criticism he had gotten the day before. And instead of patting him on the back and sympathizing, he said, man, that's great. He said, that's one woe off your back. He said, what do you mean? He said, that's something you don't have to worry about. That's not going to happen. Luke 6:26, Jesus said, woe to you when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. So that's one woe off your back. Not everybody's speaking well of you. So that's one way to look at the criticism. Let me tell you, what we're going to be doing, we're going to be looking at a criticism sandwich. And you have a handout there and you can follow right along. I call it a sandwich because we're going to get a slice of bread out of Psalms, we're going to get the meat out of Proverbs, and we'll get the bottom layer out of Ecclesiastes. Psalm 139:23-24. David prayed, search me, O Lord, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties, and see if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Isn't that a good prayer to pray? This is that Psalm 139 where David said, you know me. You know what I'm thinking, you know what I'm saying, you know where I am. You can see me in the daylight, you can see me in the dark. You knew me when I was being knit together in my mother's womb. And so he said, God, I know you. Just come on in, look around. And if you find anything wrong, let's fix it. That about as open as you can be, and that is an ideal situation to be with God. Question, how's God going to answer that prayer? When I jog, I call it an attitude adjustment talk. I get out of line pretty often. And so I have about 2.5 or 3 minutes worth of scriptures and sayings and a poem or two that I've learned, and I just talk to myself. Pray for all my family and just go through. You know how I end it? Search me, O God, know my heart. Try me and know my anxiety. See if there's any wicked way in me. Lead me in the way everlasting. I tell you what has never happened to me. I've never heard a booming voice come out of heaven. Okay, Jerry, here's something you need to straighten out today. Never have. I never had the neighbors complain. I wish you wouldn't run early in the morning and God waking all of us up. Why don't you just get on your knees at night and don't do that? Could it be that some of the people who are criticizing me are God's messenger saying, I'm going to try to straighten that fella out if he'll just listen? Something to think about. Something to think about. And where I came up with this idea, when I was at Barry's Chapel, we had staff meetings once a week. We'd have Bible study for 30 minutes. We'd do coordinating for however long it took to get everything, articles in the bulletin, and this going on, and you need to do this, and everybody gets that. And then we'd do some staff development by reading a book. So we were reading the book of Proverbs from the 12th of June of 2001 until February of 2002. We'd read a chapter a week out of Proverbs. And I kept noticing instruction, correction, reproof. I said, wow, there's a lot in Proverbs about criticism. I need to learn something about that. So I'd start circling those. And then I've done 3 or 4 weeks in isolation where I just go somewhere and I cut myself from all electronic communication, no TV, no radio, no listening to CDs or podcasts. I call Gail once a day to be sure all the family's still alive, and other than that, I'm just cut off. And I read and study. So I went back through the book of Proverbs and looked at all those passages again. I came to the conclusion that people who are critics are my friends and my helper. Anybody who comes to my house and finds salmonella in my refrigerator and tells me about it, they're not hurting me, they're helping me. Why in the world would I not want to know about that? I don't want to get sick. I don't want my kids and grandkids to get sick. Don't want that. And so anybody who does that are my helpers. Somebody made this statement: maturity is moving from a thin skin and a hard heart to a thick skin and a soft heart. Listen to what Bill Gates said. Your most unhappy customers are your greatest source of learning. Isn't that powerful? Now let's take a trip through Proverbs. Proverbs 1, 23 to 31 is wisdom personified. It's wisdom talking. And wisdom says to you and me and to Solomon's son and anybody who would read the book, if only you had listened when I corrected you. I would have told you what's in my heart. I would have told you what I'm thinking. I call, but you refuse to listen. I held out my hand, but you paid no attention. You did not follow my advice and did not listen when I corrected you. So I will laugh when you are in trouble. I will make fun when disaster strikes you. When disaster comes over you like a storm, when trouble strikes you like a whirlwind, when pain and trouble overwhelm you, then you will call to me, but I will not answer, wisdom says. You will look for me, but you will not find me. It is because you rejected knowledge and did not choose to respect the Lord. You did not accept my advice. You rejected my correction. So you will get what you deserved. You will get what you planned for others. Proverbs 3:11-12, my child, don't reject the Lord's discipline, and don't be upset when he corrects you. For the Lord corrects those he loves, just as a father corrects a child in whom he delights. Proverbs 5:7-12, Solomon is writing to his son about the evil woman. Now listen, my sons, listen to me and don't ignore what I say. Stay away from such a woman. Don't even go near the door of her house, or you will have your riches, you will give your riches to others, and the best years of your life will be given to someone cruel. Strangers will enjoy your wealth, and what you work so hard for will go to someone else. You will groan at the end of your life when your health is gone. Then you will say, I hated being told what to do. I would not listen to correction. Proverbs 9, 7 to 9. Anyone who corrects a mocker will get an insult in return. Somebody said, well, I'll tell you what I do. Somebody complains to me, I just tell them what I think about them. Well, yeah, he says that's what a mocker will do. Anyone who corrects the wicked will get hurt. So don't bother correcting mockers. They will only hate you. But correct the wise, and they will love you. Instruct the wise, and they will be even wiser. Teach the righteous, and they will learn even more. Edwin Friedman was a fellow who wrote a number of books and talked about how groups operate, family systems. He said, I'd been discussing with a client who had worked through some very difficult problems what distinguished those who succeed in changing their life course. Since he was a former boxer, I used an analogy from his sport and said that I thought it was the capacity to take a punch. To my surprise and enlightenment, he responded, you got it wrong. It's not the capacity to take a punch, it's loving it. Loving the struggle, being challenged by life, to hang in there and find new ways to think about and approach its problems. Proverbs 10, 17, whoever accepts correction is on the way to life, but whoever ignores corrections will lead others away from life. Here's a key scripture right here. Sometimes I wish the Bible were more complicated. Proverbs 12, 1, those who love knowledge want to be told when they are wrong. It is stupid to hate being corrected. That's not hard to understand, is it? It's stupid to hate being corrected. Difficult to apply, easy to understand. Sterling Seal wrote a book called How to Personally Profit from the Laws of Success. Here's what he says. One of the things that often holds us back in our success is the deliberate attempt we make to hide from the facts when the facts are unpleasant. Advice is seldom valued, though there's a great deal of advising and very little listening. Usually we do not want advice, we want flattery. And yet one cannot easily be our flatterer and our friend at the same time. Some people actually owe more to bitter enemies than to pleasant friends. Let's pause right there. I don't believe that last sentence. I believe that good friends will tell us what they like and what they don't like, and they will tell us the truth. They say that's one of the difficult things of being president of the United States and being head of other organizations. When somebody has that much power, it's hard to have somebody close to them who will tell them the truth. They want to tell them what they want to hear. So they'll get pats on the back. So I believe somebody said, you know, a friend is somebody when you will tell you when you have spinach stuck on your teeth. A friend is someone will tell you when your deodorant has quit working. Isn't that profound? There's not many people do that. They just let you go ahead and grin, and little big old green things on your teeth, and all you got to do is lick them off. Somebody just tell you, but they don't tell you. Okay, let's go ahead with what he says. An enemy is often a friend in disguise who stings us into action. He tells us the truth about ourselves. Charles Spurgeon said, get a friend to tell you your faults, or better still, welcome an enemy who will watch you keenly and sting you savagely. What a blessing such an irritating critic will be to a wise man. What an intolerable nuisance to a fool. Proverbs 13:18. If you ignore criticism, you will end in poverty and disgrace. If you accept correction, you will be honored. Proverbs 15:10. Harsh discipline is for him who forsakes the way, and he who hates correction will die. This is another quote from Bill Gates in his book, Business at the Speed of Thought. A good email system ensures that bad news can travel fast, but your people have to be willing to send you the news. You have to be constantly receptive to bad news, and then you have to act on it. Sometimes I think my most important job as CEO is to listen for bad news. If you don't act on it, your people will eventually stop bringing bad news to your attention. And that's the beginning of the end. The willingness to hear hard truth is vital not only for CEOs of big corporations, but also for anyone who loves the truth. Sometimes the truth sounds like bad news, but it is just what we need. Proverbs 15:12, a mocker resents correction. He will not consult the wise. Let me tell you my conversion story from avoiding, rejecting, ignoring criticism, and getting to accept it, invite it, and love it. First Monday of 1982, James Jones showed up at our building at Central Church of Christ in Dalton, Georgia. He was a marriage and family therapist. He had been the leader, director of Agape, child placement, child adoption, and counseling services in Atlanta. He had taught a class on counseling for elders. Our elders went down and took that class, and during that time, he started talking with them. He said, I have a number of clients in North Georgia in the Chattanooga area, and if I had a place, I think I could, they wouldn't have to drive as far, and I think I could pick up some more people. And so he worked out a deal with our elders. He rented our library every Monday for 5 hours free counseling per month to be used at the discretion of the elders. I had never talked to a counselor in my life. I'd met him, and I said, my name's Jerry Barber, and he said, my name is James Jones, and that's pretty well it. Well, he shows up on that Monday. I knew he was coming. He's in the library. My study is right across the hall, and I walk out about noon, and he walks out, and he was a rather reserved fella. He wasn't bombastic. He just kind of said, would you like to go have lunch with me today? And you know what I did? I lied to him and said yes. I didn't want to have lunch with him. I didn't want to talk to him. I didn't want him asking me questions. I didn't want him figuring me out. But we went and very uncomfortably had lunch together. Come to find out, months later, he scared me too. But we got to know each other and respect each other. And sometime later, I'd had one of those Sundays where I got stinging criticism. So I went in the secretary that morning. I said, James got any time today? She said, yeah, he's got 2 o'clock open. I said, I need it. I wanted to do two things in that counseling session. Number one, I just wanted him to agree that I was right and they were wrong, and that was a slam dunk. I mean, anybody with 1 eye and a half cents would know they shouldn't be talking to me that way. Number two, I kindly wanted but doubted if he would do what I wanted. He would often visit, maybe teach a class or something, and I was going to tell on these folks, and I wanted him to get around and say, you know, Jerry works hard. He really works hard, does a good job, and it really discourages him when people criticize him. So why don't you just not do that? I didn't figure, but I thought, you know, it won't cost any more to ask. Well, I went in and told him a story. And he paused. Looked at the floor. After I got to know him better and I got to observe him doing some counseling, that's just one of the things he'd do. He'd think before he spoke. Isn't that a pretty good idea? And I said, James, it looks to me like you're just wasting time, so they'll have to come back more times and you make more money. But that wasn't really what he was doing. So finally, after a meaningful pause, he looked me straight in the eye. He said, did it ever occur to you that not everybody likes Jerry Barber? And then I got quiet. I don't guess it ever occurred to me that everybody didn't like me. I mean, you've known me. You see anything about me folks wouldn't like? I mean, I was an only child. I had a good life growing up. Why would people not like me? So I didn't say anything. But he didn't quit talking. He said, everybody doesn't like Jerry Barber. Everybody has not liked Jerry Barber in the past. Everybody does not like Jerry Barber today. Everybody will not like Jerry Barber in the future. That's facts. That's reality. That's the way the world operates. You got two choices. Number one, if you'll let people know, and you probably do, if you'll let them know that you don't want criticism, and you communicate that verbally and non-verbally, if you let people know that you don't want criticism, not many people will criticize you until they get ready to fire you. Fire me, man. I've already been through that deal one time. I'm anxious to hear number two, because that first one, I don't want that anymore. He said, that's your first choice. Second choice is, if you will communicate to people that you are concerned and are interested in what they think and how they feel, a few people will criticize you, and many times it will really hurt. But you'll learn some things you'll never learn any other way. He said, we're through. You just got to decide which way you want to go. Wow. You know the way I like to handle criticism before that? If you as a member of the church where I preach, if you have any criticism against me, I want you to talk to my good, godly elders. I serve under the oversight of my good, godly elders. And so if you have anything, just go talk to them. And then you know what I wanted my good, godly elders to do? I wanted them to say, Jerry works hard, and he really does a good job. And it bothers him when people criticize him. Would you please not criticize him anymore? That's the way I like to deal with it, which means not dealing with it. And so from that day on, I've been working on inviting, accepting, and enjoying criticism. Listen to what C.S. Lewis said. It is no good passing over this with some vague general admission such as, of course, I know I have my faults. It's important to realize that there's some really fatal flaw in you, something which gives the others just that same feeling of despair which their flaws give you. It is almost certainly something you don't know about, like what the advertisements call halitosis, which everyone notices except the person who has it. Have you ever noticed that? I have one of the best halitosis detectors I've ever seen. You know what it is? Gail, my wife. Some days I'll go up and give her a kiss, and she says, woo-wee, you need to do something about your breath. It is powerful this morning. I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't say, boy, I got bad breath. I'm going to go out and do... When I was growing up, we had a family that moved in from Alabama, And they were just neat. They were hook fin kind of stuff. We camped out together and built a clubhouse and shot off rockets and made our own gunpowder and all that. And one of the things they really enjoyed doing in the spring, while we were waiting for the bus, they'd go up and pull wild onions and eat them as fast as they could, and then they'd get on the bus and go to the girl and go, and just. No, most of the time people with bad breath don't know it. But why, you ask, don't the others tell me? Believe me, they have tried to tell you over and over again, and you just couldn't take it. Perhaps a good deal of what you call their nagging or bad temper or queerness are just their attempts to make you see the truth. And even the faults you don't know fully. Wow. Wouldn't it be good if I could find out what those were? Proverbs 15, 31, and 32. If you listen to constructive criticism, you will be at home among the wise. If you reject discipline, you will only harm yourself. But if you listen to correction, you grow in understanding. Somebody said, yeah, that's the key. I don't mind that. I don't mind as long as it's constructive criticism. You know what that means? If you want to compliment me, I'll stay here all day long. But if you think I've done anything wrong, you're just wasting your time because I don't do stuff wrong. And all I want is constructive criticism. Well, is there all the criticism? Do you take off? No. What I have found that is helpful is just invite it, and when people do it, is there anything else I've done wrong that bothers you? I really appreciate you telling me that. Let me write that down. Okay, let me write this down. And then I'm going to think about it, and I'll decide what is constructive and what is destructive and what doesn't make a hill of beans a difference either way. It's my responsibility to sift through. I don't have to do everything everybody tells me, but I certainly don't need to cut other people off to get their insights. And so, bring it on. I'll decide what needs to be done. Proverbs 17:10, a sensible person accepts correction, but you can't beat sense into a fool. Proverbs 19:25. If you punish a mocker, the simple-minded will learn a lesson. If you correct the wise, they will be all the wiser. Proverbs 26:2. Curses will not harm someone who is innocent. They are like sparrows or swallows that fly around and never land. That simply means, if somebody says something that is obviously not true, I don't need to react to that. It's not going to get me that upset. Why would I want to validate somebody that either through ignorance or aggravation is wanting to put me down? Russell Lyon says, the only graceful way to accept an insult is to ignore it. If you can't ignore it, top it. If you can't top it, laugh at it. If you can't laugh at it, it's probably deserved. Isn't that powerful? Proverbs 27:5, 6, and 17. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Why in the world would that be? Well, I don't know. It just stings a lot of times when people openly rebuke me. Well, that's better than love carefully concealed. When somebody says, here is what aggravates me about you and one of the reasons I don't like to be around you, how's that an advantage? Tells me where I am. The best map in the world is useless if you don't know where you are. You know, you go to a hospital, motel. It has an escape route, and it says, you are here. Why do I need to know that? If I don't know where I am, I don't know what directions to follow. How am I going to get there? We were living in Dalton, Georgia. We had some people who wanted to come visit us. They had never been to our house before. It was on New Year's Day. We got a call, and they said, Jerry, I'm in town. How do I get to your house? We lived in Crow Valley, about 5-6 miles out in the country. And I said, where are you? And he said, I don't know. I said, not a way in the world I can help you. Why don't you ask somebody where you are? Well, we're at the Minute Mart on Walnut Avenue. I said, oh, yeah, get back on the interstate, go up to the Rocky-Faced exit, turn off, go up here, turn left on Crow Valley Road, be 2 3/10 miles, we're 200 feet off the road. Got to know where you are before you know where you want to go. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. What if somebody loves you, respects you, and just says, man, that person has blessed me over and over again, but they never say a word? How do you feel about your relationship with that person? Don't know. When I read that, I think of a lady at the last church where we preached. We were there 14 years. It was 11 years from the time we came until she finally said something. I think she complimented the sermon one day. I mentioned it to Gail several times. Some of the first people we met, I was trying out there. I think I told you a lot if you were here in 2014 about Barry's Chapel. I tried out with them in 1988, and it just didn't seem right. It wasn't the right time to go, and I didn't. 5 years later, I got a call from one of the elders, and they said, I don't know if you heard it or not, but our preacher resigned Sunday. Another elder and I'd like to have lunch. Will you have lunch? I said, who's paying? He said, I am. I said, yep, that's pretty well my policy. So we met at Shoney's in Brentwood, and we were having a full meal, starting off with a salad, and I was just getting started on my salad. And this elder said, boy, we are in a mess at Barry's Chapel. We got horrible problems. And I said, praise the Lord. He said, what do you mean? I said, man, that is wonderful. I said, most of the time, elders don't get this honest this early. Usually they go ahead and hire a preacher, move him there. And after he's been there about 6 months, I said, brother, we need to talk to you. We got some problems. But I said, here you are, and I ain't even got started on my salad, and you're telling me the truth. This is wonderful. Well, I got to studying more about the church and found out that they had had a fuss every 2 years for at least a decade. They had the fuss of 86, fuss of 88, fuss of 90, fuss of 92. Then I went there in 93, we had the fuss of 95. They just did it over and over and over again. So it's good to know where you are. It's good to recognize, and then how do you get out of it? Well, we had the fuss in 95, and what happened on Father's Day, June, Father's Day 1995, two of our elders resigned. Two out of three. That means we don't have an elder. We don't have an eldership. We went through a process, and November 19th, we ordained seven elders, and not a one of them had ever served a day in their life. Everything was new to them. You know, generally when you bring in a new elder, well, we'll just do it like we've always done it. How have y'all been doing? Well, this is way, okay, I just wasn't fine. But they couldn't do that because there weren't any old elders. I got a call from them in the spring of 96. I said, Jared, you got a letter today. Yep, got a letter. We did too. Would you meet us? We don't know what to do. We received an anonymous letter. See, Solomon says open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. What if it's not open? What if it's concealed? And here's the letter. That was April 27, 1996. To the good brethren of Barry's Chapel, for too long I've sat and observed the destruction of this congregation because of personal opinions and desires being placed over the will of God. This church has split several times in its history, whether we want to admit it or not, and in all those cases, it was because of personal desires of a few. Well, events over the recent period of time have made me realize that it is time to implement an eye for an eye. The comments to follow will be embarrassing to some, but the facts are true and cannot be disputed. It is time for the hypocrisy to stop, and this appears to be the most appropriate method. This letter will be sent to the four elders, the minister, and five families selected from the most recent directory. It will be mailed to all those listed in the most recent directory if immediate changes are not made. You have been judged. You have judged. Now you must be judged. Jerry Barber has done more to destroy this church than most other people. I believe the membership has dropped from the 450 Glenn Randolph helped us to grow to about 300 at the present and still shrinking. From the pulpit, Jerry is boring and does not present us with any spiritual growth or challenges. He is unfriendly and uncaring, as you prove by firing the church secretary. Jerry, have you observed your audience? Most are asleep and those awake are not listening. You're too rehearsed and you're not genuine. Very few people that know you respect you, but as you know, this is consistent with the other places you have preached. Why do so many celebrate when your family are asked to leave? According to the elders at other congregations, you have done the same thing to Bears Chapel as you have to other congregations. More specifics will be included in the following letter. And after that, it got nasty. I mean, it got bad. It went downhill from there. He insulted the elders and their family and their wives and children. But it was anonymous. Anonymous. And so their question was, we never faced this. See, what they would do, they would face a new issue, and they tried to develop a way to approach a problem when a similar problem comes up. You know what they decided? We're not going to do anything. How would you apply to it? How would you reply to it? Who would you reply to? If you start jumping every time somebody sends an anonymous letter, every time they want to see a show on Sunday morning, all you got to do is write an anonymous letter, and the elders will get up and dance a jig and say, "Whoa, got them that time, didn't they?" So they say, "We're not going to do it." I think that's pretty good. Does that sound reasonable? I have a personal policy. This is mine, not the elders at Bears Chapel. I will not respond to an anonymous letter unless it has money in it. We had moved to Bears Chapel, and this was back in the beeper days. This was before telephones, so I got a beeper. Gail and I had a code. She'd put in her number. If somebody was in an ambulance on the way to the hospital or blood was running all over the house, you'd put a 1 in. Call me right now. Number 2, I need to talk to you, but it's not critical. Number 3, when you get around. Well, it was a number 3. But I had plenty of time. I was driving down to Lewisburg to speak on a Wednesday night summer series. And I called Gail and I said, "Gail, what's going on?" She said, "Who do we know in Cincinnati, Ohio, whose last name is Moose?" And I said, "I don't know anybody in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I don't know anybody whose last name is Moose." And she said, "Well, I've called the operator and tried to find out, and they don't have a number." I said, "Well, tell me what." She said, "We got this weird letter today." Said inside the envelope was a $200 postal money order and a little sticky note on it that says, "For all you do in him." And it has a return address. A non-e-moose, and then it had a street address in Indianapolis, Ohio. I felt foolish. I went to the bank, and I said, I got this in the mail. Is this worth anything?" I said, "Yeah, it's a $200 money order, worth $200. I said, "Well, put it in my account." You know what I did? I wrote a thank you note. Anybody gives me $200, I'll write you a letter. See, they gave me the return address. "Dear Nani Moose, thank you very much for your generous gift." 6 months went by. I got a letter from East Ellijay, Georgia. $200. I wrote a thank you note. A few months went by, I got a letter from California, $100 postal money order. I deposited it. I wrote a thank you note. Some months went by, I got another $200 money order from a post office box at David Lipscomb University in Nashville. I wrote a thank you note. If you ever want to write me an anonymous letter and would like a response, please put a return address on. Let me make an observation or two. If you ever want to write an anonymous letter and get away with it, let me tell you what the best thing, have somebody else to write it, because people write like they talk. When we met that night with the elders, every one of us said, hey, I know who wrote that. That sounds just like it. I had an interesting, I held a gospel meeting at a congregation right on the border of Alabama, Tennessee, just right next to the Alabama line. And after I got back, I received a letter about three pages telling how disappointed this person was with me for moving to Nashville, Tennessee. She said, there's all kind of false doctrine being taught in Nashville, Tennessee, and I wouldn't think that a good, sound gospel preacher like you would want to live in Nashville, Tennessee. And 3 pages worth of that. And she got down to the end and said, just sign me anonymous. I guess probably out of habit on the return address was her name and address. So, need to watch your return address if you're going to do that. Let me just tell you something else. This fellow who wrote this one that I just read to you, he is one of the more progressives in our fellowship. They believe in grace, it covers everything, and they're loose as a goose and all of that. Yeah, that's the way those folks are. They're just ugly as a snake. Well, yeah. Let me read you the one from the conservatives. We cannot understand your preaching. It is too vague. What are you against? What are you for? Be specific. Incidentally, they included a classified ads in one of our gospel papers of churches looking for a preacher. You see, Christians want preachers who specifically state in no uncertain terms that they are conservative. We do not send these classifieds to you to insinuate that you should look elsewhere for work, but to show you what Christians want. Others throughout the U.S. want preachers who are sound in their teaching. We are unsure of your teachings. They leave us confused, frustrated, and fearful that we are participating in worship and works that are foreign to God. Be firm and tell us what you believe. We do not sign our names this time for fear of retribution because we do not trust where you stand with Christian love. Isn't it wonderful to be loved like that? Let me tell you what happened. It took me a while. After I'd been preaching 50 years, I included a paragraph in my job description and contract, and here's what it says. Any criticism of Jerry Barber will be directed to Jerry Barber, and it will be welcomed. Jerry Barber does not accept anonymous criticism. Boy, that works great. Now, what I tell younger preachers, you need to get your agreements written down, but don't expect the elders to remember everything that's in there. When you're courting, you'll promise anything in the world just to get married and then do what you want to after you get the ring. So you need to do that. A written agreement is not for dishonest people. A written agreement is to help us remember what we promised. This is Barber, not Bible. The only people that don't need to write down their agreements are people who are never going to die and never going to forget anything. And they need to be working with people who are never going to die and never going to forget anything. Otherwise, better write it down. Well, I don't think that's very spiritual. Back in my daddy's day, a man's word was his bond. Good, if that worked out for your dad, I'm tickled. Written agreements are not for dishonest people, they are forgetful people and people who are going to die. And so I like to write them down. But people forget. And so I was, in fact, at this congregation. First congregation I put it, one day, it always enters when people say, you know, a lot of people are upset. A lot of people are upset. Well, who are they? We can't tell you. It's confidential. Oh, okay. I can't accept anonymous criticism. That's in my contract, and so I can't break my contract. Tell them to come talk to me. I will welcome them and treat them with respect. If I don't, I'll repent. I had a call from a Kentucky preacher, and he told me, he said, my elders called me in and said, there's some people in the church that are complaining that I'm not paying enough attention to some of the folks. He said, well, great, I appreciate you. Who is it? They said, we can't tell you, it's confidential. He said, well, what am I supposed to do? They said, well, you need to pay more attention. He said, I'm already paying attention to everybody I know. I mean, I'm not neglecting, as far as I know, anybody. They said, we can't tell you. Well, you can't do anything about it. Can't do anything about it. Proverbs 29:1, if you get more stubborn every time you're corrected, one day you'll be crushed and never corrected. Again, another quote from Edwin Friedman. Much of the criticism directed at spiritual leaders is henpecking, pure and simple. It can never be made to go away permanently by trying harder to please. Despite the time bomb quality of emotionality, it is usually rather harmless in itself and will tend to self-destruct if there's no defensive feedback to keep it ticking. Proverbs 29:11, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. Brother Carroll Ellis was a Bible and speech teacher at Lipscomb. Kenneth Jones tells about one of his classes one day, illustrating what we've been talking about, how do you respond to criticism. And Brother Ellis said, if I were to walk up and down Belmont Avenue, and that's one of the streets that goes by Lipscomb University, if a man is out there on Belmont Avenue and he has one of these sandwich signs on his front back and it says, Carroll Ellis is an idiot, few people will believe him. He said, if I see that and get me a sign of the same size and write on it, Carroll Ellis is not an idiot, everybody will believe it. So sometimes the best thing to do is just don't respond. All righty, that's the meat. Let's get the bottom piece of bread and we'll wind this up. From Ecclesiastes 7, 2-6. It is better to go to a funeral than to a party. We all must die, and everyone living should think about this. Sorrow is better than laughter, and sadness has a good influence on you. A wise person thinks about death, but a fool thinks only about having a good time. It is better to be criticized by a wise person than to be praised by a fool. The laughter of fools is like the crackling of thorns in a cooking fire. Both are useless. I use that about every funeral. That's a powerful statement. I'll often open up by saying, I don't know why all of you are here today. Some of you are here because you're family. Some of you are friends of the person who is deceased. But I would hope it would be a spiritual experience for all of us. Solomon said it's better to go to a funeral than to a party. He didn't say it's more fun. He didn't say it's entertaining. It's better. Now, I'm all for parties. I preach a sermon. We need to have more funerals and more parties. We need to say goodbye to those things that are behind, and we need to celebrate how God has blessed us. That's Acts chapter 14, the last several verses. When Paul comes back to his home congregation and they talk about what the grace of God has done among them. But he said, if you're weighing them, really, there's more benefit in going to a funeral than going to a party. Why? Because that's the state of all men. I've been to thousands of funerals. I preached hundreds of funerals. But one day, if the Lord delays his return, I'm going to be going to a funeral unlike any other I've ever attended before. I'll be the man in the casket. And you know what people do at the visitation and at a funeral? They stand around the casket and talk about the person who's in the casket. You know what Stephen Covey and Michael Hyatt and several others, if you want to set goals and plan your life, here's what they recommend. Take a half a day, go out by yourself, and write your obituary. Write what you want people to say about you when they're standing around your coffin after you're dead. Write what you want your family to say, what you want your friends to say, what you want your workers, fellow workers, where you are employed, what you want the people of, and boy, lay it on thick. Man, he was great, he was honest, he was fun, whatever. She always cared, just do it. And then, after you get all of that, everything you'd like for somebody to say, start living your life so that when they say those things, they'll be telling the truth. See, Solomon said that's the end of all men and people attending a funeral. We still got time to adjust our speech. That goes with Hebrews 11:4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness of his rich, by which he obtained witness. And he, being dead, still speaks. He's been dead 1,000 years and he's still talking. Yeah, he is. And that's not only true of Cain, it's true of you and me. We'll still be talking when we're dead. So Solomon said that's the best thing to do. So that's another reason I won't be criticized. So I have an opportunity to make those adjustments. Fred Smith said, therefore, the leader must expect criticism, much as an Olympian would expect and plan for pain. I listened to Bob Richards, the Olympic gold medalist, interview younger Olympic winners of the gold. He asked them, what did you do when you began to hurt? None of these Olympians was surprised by the question. All had a specific way of handling the pain. Some prayed. After the interview, I asked Bob why he had asked about handling pain, and he said, matter-of-factly, you never get the gold without hurting. Our hope is in our pain, and criticism is often painful, but it can always be a blessing. What I started doing after James and I had this chat, mostly he was talking and I was listening, I started inviting, and once a year when I was a full-time preacher, I called it, what do you think about the preacher night? We'd have our service, and then we'd stand up here like this, and I'd have a yellow pad, and I said, okay, I get to preach to you all year long. Tonight, tell me how I can improve. Tell me what I can do personally as a preacher. Anything you'd like to tell me to improve, tell me. I promise you three things. Number one, I will listen. Number two, I'll write it down. Number three, I'll think about it. I'm not going to promise you you do everything. And man, it's amazing what you can learn. One of the first times I did this, fellow Leroy, lives two doors from our house in our subdivision, he said, Jerry, said, I know you like to read about psychology and the way people think, and said, I think that you understand that a person can only concentrate about 16 and a half or 17 minutes at a time. I said, Leroy, what I hear you saying is I preach too long. He said, you got it. I said, thank you for getting us started out. I wrote that down. Well, Brother Harlan Roark, sitting right back here, he got up and said, I'll tell you one thing. If you ain't going to preach no longer than that, I ain't going to get cleaned up and drive in from Pegram. The best thing we can do is to let people talk to each other. See, what did we just learn from that? Everybody doesn't have the same opinion. Leroy's wants 16 and a half, 17 minutes, probably 12 or 8 would be better for him. And Brother Roark said, if you're not going to do it anymore, it's not worth getting dressed and coming to town. At Bear's Chapel, the first time we did that, we set the rules for discussion. Debbie held her hand up and said, Jerry, said, I like you and like your preaching, But she said, you do a lot of series. You preach on the same topic week after week after week after week. I wish you'd quit doing that. Thank you. Brother Channing Workman held up his hand. He said, Jerry, I've been thinking, praying about this for some time. Said, I really think what we need at Bear's Chapel is a good series of sermons on forgiveness. I said, let me write it down, write it down. And a lot of times it's real easy. Sister Charlotte came up, or rather she said in the discussion, she said, sometimes you preach a good sermon. And when you do, I'd like to tell you I enjoyed it. But you always stand back here at these two doors. I always go out this door, and by the time I see you the next time, I've already forgot about it. Man, that's easy. That'll be Sunday morning. This will be first and third Sunday nights, second and fourth Sunday nights over here. I got to speak to young people. I never thought about that. I just thought the preacher had to stand at the double back doors. No, I didn't split it up. And so we can learn a lot of things. And also it can be a blessing. I'd been at Dalton, Georgia several years, and one day a lady came in the afternoon, and she closed the door and she started weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping. She just couldn't say anything. And finally, when she had pretty well cried out and able to talk, she said, Brother Barber, I don't know what I'm going to do. I feel so guilty. I don't know what I'm going to do. She said, I know that people who are Christians don't have mental illness in their family. And I'm just so upset and feel so guilty. I don't know what I'm going to do. She was having to put her daughter in the hospital for emotional issues. Remember what I read to you, our preacher's too young, too immature, too tried, I get nothing from his services, and now he's my Sunday school teacher too. That was on the front. Here's what was on the back. I hate everything and everybody. When I hear someone laugh, I want to hit them. Why should they have something to laugh about when I don't? I said, Sister, could I tell you a little bit about my family background? She said, well, sure. I said, oh, my daddy's side, his daddy, my granddaddy, spent most of his adult life in Central State Hospital on Murfreesboro Road in Nashville, Tennessee, the state hospital for mental illness. I only remember seeing him home one time. The rest of the time we visited him in the hospital. My daddy's only brother, they said one time when my granddad was home visiting, something happened in the barn and nobody ever knew, but from that day, his life was changed. He went to Central State Hospital and stayed 6 years, and for 6 years, nobody, doctor, nurse, or family member ever heard him say a word. Daddy had a sister who had shock treatments for depression. On my mother's side of the family, my granddaddy committed suicide, an uncle committed suicide, a first cousin committed suicide, and mother had two sisters who went every 10 years for shock treatments to deal with their depression. She said, Brother Barber, all that's happened to your family? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, I thought you was a good Christian. I said, well, by the grace of God, Jesus has done a lot for me, and I'm trying to accept all the gifts he had. If we share what we have with other people, many times we have an opportunity. And here this lady gives me this criticism, and now it makes sense. Now it makes sense. Criticism may be slightly more tolerable than a root canal, but that doesn't mean we should avoid it. In fact, we should invite it. Criticism is the breakfast of champions. Any of you familiar with Barbara Johnson? Grass Grows Greener on the Septic Tank and other such books. She ran a ministry called Spatula Ministry. She said it's for scraping the parents off the ceiling whose children have run them up the wall. And she had a lot of grief in her family, deaths and husband stroke and just all kind of things. Here's my mustard seed from everything that Barbara Johnson wrote. Hurt people hurt people. I noticed in my library, in my file cabinet, that criticism came before crucifixion. And we say, I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And if I'm willing to be crucified with Christ, I ought to be willing to be crucified or to be criticized for the same reason. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we want to talk about really bad stuff, bullying, malicious criticism. How do I deal with that? Thank you for your good attention.
Open up with another song.